Widespread government censorship is still happening in many parts of the world, and that includes censoring activity and content on the internet. And that's very much the case in Venezuela, where there was a recent presidential election just this past summer, which only exacerbated the issue. So with us today to talk about government internet censorship in Venezuela is Andres Azpurua, the executive director of an internet freedom and advocacy group in Venezuela, very much focused on using data to hold those who would impede the freedom of information accountable. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Andres, thank you so much for joining today. It really is a pleasure to have you on in doing the preparation for today's show. I really found it intriguing, the topic, the content of what we're going to be discussing today, especially in light of the recent elections just last month in Venezuela. So thank you. And Doug, of course, for coming on again as an honored guest and co-host from time to time. Really is a pleasure to have you as well. Now, you two both have a history together. But before we get into that, Andres, can you give us a little bit of a background about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So I'm executive director of Conexión Segura y Libre, which we translate as Free and Secure Online. It's a human rights or a digital human rights NGO. We document with a technical perspective, with a technical eye, digital threats against human rights. We also develop and facilitate civic technology, and we help train and respond to digital security incidents that Venezuelan civil society and independent journalists might have with a varied set of threat actors who sometimes include state actors.
And your focus is entirely within the country of Venezuela, of course, is that right?
Not entirely. It's our main focus. We have trained folks from different NGOs in different countries on some of the stuff we do. So like documenting internet censorship with everything from standardized tools that our community uses, but also like how to analyze package captures and try to understand what's going on with the censorship and stuff like that, and how to articulate that technical data or those measurements into advocacy.
I see. And so what your organization does is certainly intertwine with the ongoings on a political scale on the actual country of Venezuela. But from what you just said, you really come at it from a very technical perspective. Of course, intermeshed very much with how that the technical components of how the internet operates, how that interplays with society at large. But it is from a very technical perspective, it sounds like.
Yeah, indeed. We're the very uncommon human rights NGO that has more engineers than any other profession in the team.
Yeah, yeah. And Doug, how have you and Andres just mentioned internet measurement, which is your area of expertise. So may I ask how the two of you got to know each other?
Well, I mean, this is our first time speaking. We've been trading messages on and off, I don't know, for many years. One of us will, there's a whole community of people in the digital rights space who in the behind the scenes send messages to each other like, hey, do you have data on this? I do or I don't, or go over to this person or this other organization. So in the course of that kind of work, I think we've traded messages, but this is our first time speaking, and I didn't mention it, but Andres is calling us from Caracas, Venezuela. And I think, for our podcast, our audience is typically engineers, network engineers. We have a technical audience, but they aren't necessarily international affairs majors. So, Andres, would you maybe just briefly describe the current political situation in Venezuela? Excuse me. And then maybe we can relate that to how does that reflect or affect digital rights.
Sure. So exactly 1 month ago, we had a presidential election in Venezuela, the results of which have been, let's say, criticized by all manner of audiences. They're not believable results. The results have been put into question by the Venezuelan opposition, by Venezuelan civil society, and the Venezuelan public at large. Not absolutely everyone, of course, but it's very widely considered to be not the real results. So this has been the position of many governments throughout the world, from everything from left-leaning governments, such as Brazil's Lula da Silva or Colombia's Petro, all the way to the US or the EU. The panel of experts from the UN doesn't believe the results, in a very strongly worded message for whatever is the standard at the UN. It was unusually straightforward for a UN text. And similarly, the Carter Center, which also had people in the country at the time, said that this didn't comply with any of the minimum standards for transparency or any democratic election. Since then, it's been a lot of repression and internet censorship and persecution, frequently used in conjunction with technology. So a lot of surveillance technology being in place, using technology to identify protesters and to create a lot of fear. So a lot of social media messages coming from the state trying to create fear so people wouldn't speak out on social media or on the streets, even if peacefully. So there's a lot going on, and there's been a lot of censorship during the election campaign. We saw a dramatic increase of internet censorship, and since then, even more.
So the election took place 1 month ago, but you've been at this work for a long time.
Yes.
And this situation, this is just the latest, but the situation has been going, for a long time. So how long has your organization existed? How long have you been doing this?
So I have to say that it's hard for me to say exactly when the organization started, since we started without an actual founding document.
But many years ago.
Somewhere.
It's many years ago.
But yeah, over 10 years ago, for sure. And our investing filter, the our project that documents those digital threats against human rights, particularly internet censorship, has more than 10 years. I recently had to go to when did I register this domain? And it's over 10 years ago.
Okay.
So I'll put that at least 10 years ago, we started doing all of this.
So in your the Vesfiltro Twitter handle or X handle, you are often using the IOTA data to highlight outages. So there's seems like in your work, and occasionally I do something to analyze Venezuela, it seems like the variety of things that take place are, there's a lot of outages due to power outages or just old infrastructure, just things breaking, maybe more than they would in another country. There's also, as you described a minute ago, some of the politically motivated disabling service in a particular part of the country, or blocking a website or social media service. I also recall at one point, and maybe this still takes place, of blocking websites that report on the black market exchange rates for currency, which is, I think, maybe something we don't typically think about when we think about digital rights leasing in the United States, but that is another big issue in Venezuela.
Yes, indeed. For a long time, the main category of websites that got blocked was indeed websites that published the black market exchange rate for US dollars to Venezuelan bolivares. But with time, the most sensitive category or the most important focus for the censorship moved around for different things. But as the focus of internet censorship moved with what's the most sensitive topic for the government, so that's when the most prevalent censorship moved. Right now, I would say that for sure the most pervasive internet censorship applies to news media. So we have over 60 news websites blocked. If we look at it via like how many domains, the list would be much larger because multiple websites have multiple domains in order to circumvent that censorship. But more than 60%, more than 60 news websites are blocked in Venezuela, including most of the Venezuelan independent news ecosystem. So it's really, really hard to get any form of independent news in Venezuela by just browsing the web. Any websites you can think will likely get blocked. If you see tweets with links to a news article, if you click on those links, it would likely not load for you. If your family or your WhatsApp group is sharing something about an important news article and you click on it, it won't open most likely because of the internet censorship. We have also had internet shutdowns, and we have also seen moments in which social media is like the most important thing to block. In 2019, we recorded many, many cases where we had internet censorship against WhatsApp, Twitter, Facebook, Periscope at the time, Instagram, anything where people could do some live streaming, because the live streaming was the most sensitive thing at the time in order to prevent folks to getting news in real time. Things had moved, different techniques had been implemented. For example, those blocks against social media and streaming platforms mostly happened, were as short as possible. So they didn't implement it via DNS blocking, which is the most common type of censorship that we see here and most of around the world, I would say. But we use different types of internet censorship in order to be like more precise. And like, I want the block to start right now. I don't want the block to end at this moment specifically, to make it as short as possible, to, I assume, limit the political and reputational cost of that censorship, but at the same time, make sure that the live event was not shared live. So we have many types of things going on.
Andres, on the DNS blocking or tampering, is it are the queries intercepted or do they just have like the major ISPs put in a bad record for DNS? Like if you were a user and you went to like 8.8.8.8 switch your DNS, would you be able to get around it or are they intercepting the queries so you wouldn't be able to get around it?
So for the most part, it's just the ISPs, their own DNS servers have bad records, so you either get an NX record. Or you get an empty reply, or sometimes you get a local host like 127.0.0.1 response. You get just a loopback address as the A record for a domain, which won't work for sure. Depending on the ISP, but some ISPs do block like access to the actual like public DNS. So we have some public DNS servers who are blocked, and we have also seen some DNS package dropping, but it's not very prevalent. And we also seen some DNS package injection, in which the ISP through their middle boxes would inject responses pretending to be, let's say, Google's public DNS or Quad 1 or Quad 9 or whatever. So you would get, like, if you do package capture in those incidents, you would get two responses, but the first one you get is the fake forged response, and that's the one the computer uses. And then you get either the wrong response that will not lead you to the website that you wanted, or more likely what you get is a phishing website. And this has been used by the state-owned telecoms to create massive phishing campaigns against dissidents, because then when people try, even if they typed the correct URL, they will get to the wrong website. And if they hadn't had HTTPS turn on, they just didn't notice. And if they did have HTTPS turn on, they just get a browser warning that people have been, for different reasons, been already like trained to ignore. So it's also like one of those things about how even if there's some features in the browsers, if people are just accustomed to ignoring those browser warnings for different unrelated reasons, then people will not pay attention to those when it actually matters, and they're actually protecting you from a phishing website.
So in Venezuela, like you mentioned, like the getting a bad query, bad, you know, query response will beat the good query, and your computer uses that. It's how you know, I don't know that it does this anymore, but the Great Firewall at one point, like 10 years ago or so, used to do that. In fact, you could sit outside the China. You can go from the United States and send in these queries and you get the responses back. They've since locked that up. But there's no Great Firewall of Venezuela, to my knowledge. So the government gives an order and each ISP has to implement this separately. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Each ISP has their own tools. Some use just DNS censorship. Some have mailboxes.
So it creates some variability. Does that create some variability between, you know, what provider you're using to connect and what censorship you may experience?
Yes, for sure. And in some cases, you'll be able to just circumvent it by changing your DNS. And in some cases, you won't have that as an option. Or at least it won't work for most websites.
Is there DPI, like deep packet inspection stuff going on?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. So you see a lot of HTTP host on HTTPS, like the TLS handshake being monitored. So either the HTTP host of an HTTP request or the SNI for a TLS handshake are being looked at by censorship equipment, and then you get some, like, your connection may be reset or your package dropped, depending on, like, on the HTTP host or the SNI. So you see both kinds of filtering in Venezuelan networks at the moment, but you also see just DNS, and it's very common to see also different blocking techniques being used in tandem on the same ISP. So you it's very common to find DNS censorship and SNI filtering and HTTP host blocking. So HTTP, HTTPS censorship and DNS censorship, or you might have seen, like, I don't know, some things are blocked via IP blocking, and some things which could be as simple as, I don't know, a routing table just set to something that doesn't work. And at the same time, other types of censorship in tandem.
So I know a little about the telecom landscape in Venezuela. So you've got Comte is the incumbent. Is that what most people use to connect, or are they using some of the other competing mobile providers?
Yeah, so Comte is the largest. So AS8048, if you want to look for it.
I knew that. You could have tested me. I would have known that.
So Comte is the largest residential ISP by far. It used to be even larger, but we've seen a significant increase since, like, I don't know, year one of the pandemic, when the Venezuelan internet suffered tremendously because it was not well set up for folks just going to their homes and then trying to use the internet from home. Where it suffered, there's been a lot of, like, opening of the market for either less traditional ISPs or at least traditional ISPs to start offering fiber to the home in much larger numbers. And there's still a tremendous gap. Venezuela had, like, many, many years of underinvestment in their telecom infrastructure. And that's how you see it in, like, all of the outages that you see. And there's, like, a huge chunk of Cantebe clients that are still on copper wires. And some of those, they haven't had internet for years. Not weeks or days. I mean, we're talking about years without internet service because the infrastructure is just broken at so many points that they just decided to not continue working on it and just wait until eventually fiber gets to your house. And they're not, like, changing cables that are, like, corroded or changing DSL equipment at different nodes because they just decided not to care much about investing in upkeeping that copper network anymore. And that also happens with some private ISPs that they had decided to just let it, that their coaxial network, their HFC network, to just die because they're just investing everything on fiber optic and let their old network die and customers who just lose access to the network. They just, oh, you have to wait until we get to you with fiber optic at a price point that most Venezuelans can't afford. It's like an order of magnitude of a different price point. So most Venezuelan users can't afford that, like the new fiber optic services. But definitely Cantebe continues to be the largest by far residential ISPs, both like with a DSL and a fiber optic offering.
They don't do mobile, Cantebe.
They have a subsidiary with a different AS.
Okay.
That provides mobile internet. It's one of the only three mobile operators in the country. It's the smallest one of the three. Again, because it's much easier to just change mobile operators. And when the lack of investment start to show really bad on that ISP, people on that mobile operator that decided to change to a private offering. But it continues to be a significant amount of users. It's just the smallest of the three.
Does your organization catalog and record each of these types of disruptions and, you know, either, you know, something breaking due to old infrastructure or something getting blocked? Is that one of the objectives or some of the work products?
We try.
Okay.
We definitely try. We're not always we can. So for example, last night when, I mean, many Venezuelan states lost power for a few minutes, 15, 30 minutes, maybe up to an hour. At some points, we're not 100% sure. At the time, it was late at night. But we did report it mostly based on IOTA data. And we were able to, that was a very clear case of the network outage and the drop in connectivity measured as the number of up /24 network segments that were visible from the internet. You could see how it affected multiple states, and it's pretty obvious that it was just a power outage. Sometimes we have to look like it was just one ISP who dropped. Are there any reports of upstream providers having difficulties? Are there any public reports of anything? Like maybe we can get this social and ask folks like, hey, is there a power outage in such state? Or do you have any reasons why we're seeing a drop in this network? And then we can like come to a conclusion on what's the reason for the outage. Sometimes it's very obvious. Sometimes we need to ask for folks. Maybe some folks have like some other information that it's not as public. And eventually, sometimes we just don't know and we just report it as unknown.
I know a number of years ago, maybe you and I talked about this. I remember reporters from Venezuela reaching out because there was another countrywide internet problem, and the government was saying it was a submarine cable outage in the Caribbean. I went and looked into it, and I did find evidence. It seemed like it hit Venezuela harder than other countries. But what I found was everybody was so used to combating lies from the government that it was very hard to convince anybody there actually was a submarine cable problem. I think in that case, it's possible they were telling the truth, and everyone's already pre-programmed to assume it's a lie. You mentioned IOTA, and I think I mentioned as well. So for anyone listening, this is the Internet Outage Detection and Analysis Service put together by Georgia Tech, our friends over there. It is a free, there's like a web page. It's very API accessible. I use it, Andres uses it. I think a lot of people in the digital rights space rely on this. And what it does is for each AS, each country, it'll track like the BGP routes that are up. They have some active measurements, some ping stuff going on. There's a few other metrics that they pull in from like Google and there's other projects, but it's a handy way to just for free, just go check, see if there's problems in a particular country or a network. I think we both make a lot of use of that. That's a good thing, good tool to know about.
Yeah, it's reasonably good. It has a good interface, especially if you're not intimidated by many graphs and many it's a technical tool for folks who are I would put my mom into checking that website, I would say. But we also consult the API a lot, so it's useful. The API access that it provides is very useful, because then you can make your own graphs and make your own dashboards if you need out of that data.
Do you make use of UNI data as well? So UNI,
yes,
is the Open Observatory for Network Interference put on by the Tor Group. So this is a bit more like you have like a handset on your phone. You've got an app that's running and testing things. And it provides some technical analysis on when it can't reach something, how it broke, and that can inform, you know, some idea of how the censorship is taking place. But is that something you use as well?
Yeah, we have network probes who run UNI automatically, headless. So they're just Raspberry Pis basically. And we have a schedule for different tests and different measurements on those devices. And we also use UNI on handsets, basically from volunteers, basically. So we coordinate extra measurements as we need through volunteers on their handsets. But you also have this automated systematic coverage of test lists on hardware probes. And we're hoping to also include other automatic measurement things. In the past, we have also had a RIPE NCC Atlas probes.
Sure.
We currently are not deploying those, but we had in the past. We do use RIPE Atlas on some measurements, despite not hosting any Atlas probes at the moment.
How do you make use of the Atlas probes? You're like pinging or doing DNS queries and pinging things, or?
We can do DNS queries. We can also try to do ping. There's depending on the type of censorship, you can also detect some, like confirm some things with very specific HTTPS requests. Since you can't do HTTPS, for what I remember, they'll try to do the TLS handshake, but only to their own anchor. Measuring anchors, so it's like you can't do a TLS request to an arbitrary server. Sure. But since
they don't want people DDoSing using the RIPE Atlas for
sure, and they're very clear that they're preventing abuse. They're not allowing that to prevent abuse. But since you can indeed do those TLS handshakes to specific servers, if you craft that TLS handshake in a very specific way, you can test to see if some of those attributes are being filtered for censorship, and we have been doing that occasionally. But mostly, it's checking the trace routes from different ASs. Currently, as we speak, I'm pretty sure last night it was not available, the website for the election authorities in Venezuela. So, like, if we want to test, like, is it accessible on all kinds of networks, then we can just, I don't know, make hundreds of pings or make hundreds of trace routes from different parts of the network, just to see, like, from different parts of the world, say, hey, so in most networks in the world, you can't access this website. Or if you want to compare, I don't know, DNS records being put out internationally versus the DNS records that we get locally for some state websites. So then we can also do that. Get a couple hundred or 50, I don't know, DNS records from random probes in the internet that exclude Venezuela, and then make our own measurements from Venezuela. And then we can compare and we can say, hey, so maybe if some people are claiming that, I don't know, a public state-owned website is visible only inside of the country, which happens frequently, we can get some numbers and get some data on that to confirm if in fact it's happening, and if it's happening, why. And sometimes it's just because of the DNS that they're just like local networks are answering differently than the DNS resolution outside.
Sure.
Andres, you've been speaking a lot about the technical component of how you measure the activity on the internet and censorship, and a lot of it being state-sponsored censorship. But I'd like to understand why you do what you do. I can guess, of course, but I'd like to hear it from you. So, you know, starting with why you and others chose to found the organization, Conexión Segura y Libre, but why you came to found it with others. And then, of course, what is the current focus of your work? I understand that you're measuring these metrics and you're trying to understand it from a technical perspective, but what's the goal?
Sure. So We started working on this on the organization over a decade ago. I had been I've been an activist for a while by then. Starting with the Venezuelan student movement in 2007. I'm older than I look for those who are actually seeing me, we were active in protests demanding freedom of speech, especially at a time where not internet censorship but censorship of traditional media was scaling rapidly, and there were many human rights concerns even back in the day. And that turned into a more organized form of activism, into civil society organizations. I started working on some civil society organizations that we helped create as a new cohort, a new generation of young people caring about human rights and civil rights. But eventually I grew to realize that there were many things happening, and they're going to start happening even more, that traditional human rights organizations were not equipped to understand. So internet censorship, surveillance, we're talking about other forms of repression that traditional human rights NGOs didn't have the language, the understanding, and if they are very capable of, if they know how to, I don't know, record evidence and save the evidence and do advocacy around that for traditional human rights violations, like, I don't know, maybe there's video, photos of police misconduct or something like that, but traditional human rights NGOs were not capable, were not really equipped to understand similar or equivalent phenomena that happened using technology. So that, in addition to the traditional civil society in Venezuela's lack of technical capacity in general. So even if it's just about, like, let's start using Twitter or let's start using social media. I mean, that communication side of things, they quickly grew. But there are many things that technology can be an important tool for, either bringing activists together or bringing citizens together, and even facilitating the communication between local governments and citizens, like civic technology kind of things. And we realized that there's so many gaps in that space, and we decided to create our organization, which back then was called Venezuela Inteligente, and make that space, make that happen, a space where we could help facilitate civic technology for Venezuelan citizens and civil society, but also provide this technical perspective to violations to human rights, especially some violations to human rights in Venezuelan civil society we're not able to really understand. So imagine basing internet censorship just on people's, I don't know, Twitter complaints that a website is not accessible. Sure, I mean, you can get some info out of that, but you won't be able to say definitely that the government is censoring the internet just because some people couldn't access a website. There are many reasons why that person couldn't access it. But in our case, we can have network measurements that are consistent over time, consistent with different vantage points. And more than once, we have been criticized, like, no, you guys are lying, or you guys are making this up. Like, hey, do you have anyone you can trust that can read, like, PCAPs? Or you have anyone that you can trust that can, like, analyze this network measurements? Yeah. And you'll come to similar conclusions. And we have more than once, like, especially when we have been documenting more sophisticated threats, such as this DNS response injection to facilitate state-sponsored phishing attacks on a massive scale. Like, more than once, that people who are, like, with a technical background, come on, that can't be true. It's like, well, here are the PCAPs. Here are the UNI measurements.
Right.
Here are the RIPE Atlas measurements. You can just look it on yourself. Here are, like, I don't know, you can do the DNS history, and you can do, like you can do redo the same OSINT that we did to identify which state offices were participating in that attack. And then you'll come to similar or the same conclusions. And that's also an important part of doing this with a strong technical perspective, is to ensure that you're not just claiming things, but you also have the evidence to back it in case people don't believe you, but also in general, because it's a good practice. We're not just claiming that there are massive systematic violations to human rights on Vibes. We are claiming that based on evidence.
So then the organization would say that open and free access to the internet and ultimately to information that is available on the internet is part of the human rights movement as well.
For sure. We define ourselves as a human rights organization or a digital human rights organization. And we do many things that human rights organizations do. We provide reports with a human rights perspective. We communicate and engage with other advocacy groups on human rights. Mm-hmm. We collaborate and share data with UN agencies, including the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and special freedom of speech rapporteurs or the right to privacy rapporteurs, because we see these as human rights violations. We're just documenting it and contextualizing them with a technical perspective so that we know like how big it is. Or like when we go through Telefonica's transparency records, we're not just taking them at face value, we're contextualizing it in a way that I would say most traditional human rights NGOs are not able to really understand it. And while we also provide
It's okay. I could see on over your shoulder your poster. Los derechos digitales son derechos humanos. Digital rights or human rights. It kind of captures what you're saying a minute ago.
Yeah, exactly. And we also see like access to privacy and security preserving techniques and tools is also a human right. And we facilitate and provide training and incident response to folks who are on the civic space in Venezuela, who require them or are under attack. So like, I don't know, anything you can think about cybersecurity or digital security that, independent newsroom might need, we are often like with them, helping them so that they have a more secure organization, just like with citizens and activists, which I mean, like you can think like, sure, keep your devices up to date, and it's very important to make sure you have the latest version of your OS and stuff like that. But also, like, how can you hide apps when you go outside and you might get stopped by cops and they might demand to see the contents of your phone? So how can you hide WhatsApp chats? How can you hide Signal from your phone? Like, how can you create, I don't know, many different things that are not like the traditional, let's say, cybersecurity thing that you think about, but also more traditional, also cybersecurity training, like, hey, like how careful are you into not falling into phishing emails, which might or might not be state sponsored or politically motivated, but you might still like be under attack. From those vectors.
So the extent of the censorship in Venezuela is beyond manipulating DNS responses and perhaps not propagating certain prefixes to block access to Twitter. There are cops on the street looking at your phone, and you have no recourse. Correct?
Yeah, that is happening. Especially in it can happen anytime. It was very prevalent in the first few weeks after the election results. It was it was twofold. On one side, it was trying to capture folks who might be coming from a protest, going to a protest, or just might be interested in participating in protests. But at the same time, it created a lot of fear. We saw during the first few weeks after the election a very intentional and very well designed campaign to create fear, so that folks wouldn't go out to protest or publish their opinions online. You would see uncommon things such as, imagine official social media accounts for security forces. This could be intelligence, this could be just national police or specific offices like penal investigation offices for police. And they would upload videos that are just, they had like creepy music, they had many, many horror movie tropes, and they were just basically, it's it's hard to explain. If you see those videos, it's very clear what they're trying to do. But basically, they capture snippets from social media of someone protesting or claiming, doing something, saying things against the government or not recognizing the results they published, and just immediately they had the same script almost all the time. Then like a creepy like the guy from Saw with a mask, or you have Chucky, the possessed doll, and then you had like these commandos like dropping out of helicopters, sort of vans or stuff like that. And then they'll capture the person, make the person ask for forgiveness on camera, on the like while being held by the cops. And it's like, I'm sorry if I insulted the president and stuff like that. And then after that, they'll like close like a jail cell on top of them and then put the logo of the cops. All of this through like with creepy music and creepy effects. As if it was just a horror movie. There are hundreds of such videos online. Yeah. And the president himself, he claimed that over 2,000 people were just detained on the first few days after the election. And he was just saying that we're going to open new state-of-the-art prisons just to get all the news, these news, newly detained people that we had new thousands of folks. We just got detained and we're going to create new prisons, open new state-of-the-art prisons just for them. And that's the kind of rhetoric. So here we saw the conjunction of internet censorship, misinformation and disinformation, actual detention and repression on the streets, and these kinds of social media posts to create fear. All of them, like those four pillars, work together for even more, make each other more effective when they're used this way together than any of them individually. And that was what was happening. And I can go on to more surveillance tech in Venezuela, but yeah. We'll go off topic.
Can I just ask one? May I ask, do you or your colleagues face, what are the risks that you guys face with the work that you do? Do you, like, how would you answer that question? Because it seems like challenging is kind of an understatement. Like, you guys face risk.
It is. And there's likely more of those risks coming. I mean, I would say that there's like, on the horizon, there's a new set of laws targeting civil society that are about to come into place, who will likely be used as legal basis or excuse to more widely persecute civil society organizations. We do try to minimize the number of folks in our organization that have like a public facing profile. Some of the folks in our team work from abroad, but other part of our team works inside of the country, and we just limit the number of people inside of the country who have a public facing profile as much as possible. And since this started happening after the election, we have, for example, stopped sharing videos with our face on. We have started being far more careful about like some folks have occasionally being like spokespersons for the organization, but then we have to like seriously like close it down to just as the minimal crew, let's say, having public facing.
But you are a spokesperson or a public figure in your organization.
And even then, I haven't uploaded any videos showing my face to our social media accounts recently, just because you never know who's going to see you and say, oh, maybe that guy's the next guy we're going to get. And now we also like turn down interviews in Spanish or important interviews in Spanish. We have had to make sure someone from outside of the country is taking that interview. So like maybe I've been on the BBC, but not in CNN Spanish because has different audiences and that's sort of like the kind of things we're trying to separate so that they're not as visible inside of the country. So I don't know, maybe I can quote our publishing like our posts or reports, but they're not as likely to be like, I don't know, showing our face on TV or stuff like that you can see here.
Now, I noticed just in hearing the explanation of what the organization does, there are some parallels with the Internet Society. And we have interfaced with the Internet Society several times on this podcast with several individuals over there, including the person who runs the organization.
Is that the case?
Is that the case with you, Andres? Are you also, do you also from time to time interface with Internet Society? Do you have a background with them at
all? Well, yes. I was president of the Venezuelan chapter of ISOC. And I was involved for many years in the chapter. I continue to be a member and collaborate with chapter leaders in the country, but I don't have any specific responsibilities. I've tried to make our data or analysis available for some ISOC projects like Internet Pulse, I think it's called, without a lot of success. But I do think like ISOC's work in general is very important. But I do think that ISOC's work internationally is very important. ISOC chapters around the world have a tremendous impact. I just wish they could have sometimes be stronger, just to push for policies that internet users are all around the world. So we need strong ISOC chapters, I would say, and civil society in general, pushing for local policies that facilitate the developing of internet that reaches and benefits all in all of the countries. And we also need the standard setting support that ISOC provides, as well as opinion leadership that ISOC also provides on many other issues that are related to the internet. And I think those are very important.
Yeah, and it seems to me that that's where the two organizations diverge, whereas they are focused much more on policy and the opinion leadership, thought leadership that you mentioned, whereas you are certainly involved with that, but much more from a technical perspective and analyzing the data and then providing the data to hold the nation and other organizations accountable for their activities.
I would straight up saying that our goal with measuring internet censorship and doing advocacy around it is increase the political cost of internet censorship to prevent more censorship to come, or at least reduce the amount of censorship we're going to face in the future, or push for a reversal of some censorship techniques. We have seen how being fast and strong, especially with backing of international civil society about specific censorship techniques in Venezuela and in many parts of the world, will lead to a more better chances for that censorship measurement to be pulled down in order for the government still being able to save face. If you come out as soon as possible, hey, this is happening. Why is X thing or not X thing, something being blocked? I mean, it could be X. And it is, Venezuela blocked Twitter or X and is blocked currently. It also blocks Signal, the secure messaging app, which many folks listening should be aware. And those kinds of tools and many VPNs also, if you have very, very common popular VPNs services, their websites are blocked, or the government actively tries to block, or different ISPs actively try to block the functioning of the VPN itself. So you have API servers or API endpoints for VPN services being blocked, or they try to actively block circumvention techniques in addition to just blocking websites and hoping folks don't use VPNs. They also go to the VPNs. But the idea for us here is just, again, document things, keep a record of those human rights violations, and also increase the political and reputational cost of censorship and other state-sponsored attacks.
Yeah, and metaphorically speaking, shining light on the methods and mechanisms used to censor an entire society will adversely affect their ability to continue doing it. They're going to have to become more sophisticated and spend more money and more time and more resources. And then in turn, you'll continue to shine that light. So they have to continually backpedal and be on the defensive. So that sounds like the main underlying goal right?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah. It has been true. I mean,
with data, which you can't argue.
Exactly, with data. And if you have, like, they would be more than content to just apply DNS blocking and for it to be the end of it. But we are there, like, helping folks resist that internet censorship. So they have to go out different technologies in order to continue to have partially effective blocks or effective blocks that go beyond DNS blocking because people are then using like VPNs or other circumvention techniques.
Andres, is there any ways that people in our audience can help your cause or your effort? What can people do if you were to ask? Because you've laid out a really compelling mission of your organization, and I think I, along with probably a lot of people, are thinking like, is there something I can do to help? Is there anything we can do?
Well, I mean, I don't have anything that I can like clearly say. I don't know if you're a Flutter developer and just have like free time. I mean, sure. I mean, we'll take those. We have our own technology that we provide for Venezuelan civil society. We have, for example, a anti-censorship newsreader that functions with VPN protocols and even uses some VPNs, like infrastructure from existing VPN providers and some of our own. But it's just a newsreader, so it's like a more streamlined experience for less technical users in Venezuela. Just open the newsreader and have like a feed of news and you click on it and you see the website. But you have to, I don't know, log into a VPN service or continue to pay it or stuff like that. So we have our own things. And I mean, there's some crisis moments when sometimes we just need like extra analysis eyes, to be honest. But most of the time,
okay. maybe we could talk after the recording.
If you have any ideas, if you can contribute some way, or maybe like, hey, exactly, you can just email us. And after we vet who you are, because we can't obviously I don't know. Sometimes collaborate with folks.
Of course.
We don't know the provenance, like because of the kind of things we do and the type of communities we serve. But yeah, like if you have technical background and you think you can collaborate in some ways, like off the get-go, if you're a Flutter developer, even if you don't speak Spanish and you have free time, we need one of those, like ASAP.
What is it? A filter developer?
Yeah. So Flutter is Flutter is just a software development that. Library tool from Google for mobile apps, and there's, I don't know, we just need someone. But yeah, like I don't know, if you're a DevOps expert or something, we do have some needs. The thing is very hard for me to just like list them, but we do have some technical needs.
Yeah, sure. I guess if nothing else, we can all give you a retweet or a repost or a follow you and try to extend your public message to a wider audience, because you have a public advocacy mission as well that anybody with a computer might be able to
retweets are
do
free.
A little part there. Okay, that's right. So far. As of today.
Andres, it really has been a pleasure to have you today. Really interesting conversation. And thank you so much for the work that you and your organization, those in your organization do. We appreciate that. Now, for finding out more information, where can folks find you, your organization, or whatever you want to point people to online?
Well, I would say that the most significant place I can point folks are is vesinfiltro.org. Which is going to be messy to spell out, but maybe it's in the show notes. Or
vesinfiltro.
Yeah, so that's the website, not for the whole of the organization, but our, let's say, documentation program, our human rights documentation program, and we often publish in Spanish, but occasionally publish in English as well, and. And that's where we publish our reports, our analysis, and many of the most significant alerts. Also, vesinfiltro on Twitter or X. It's a good place to follow us. We have many other social things, but those are the ones that are, I think, more relevant for an English-speaking audience that's outside of the country.
All right, well, we're going to end it here. Again, thank you, Andres, and thank you, Doug, for joining. Now, if you have an idea for an episode or you'd like to be a guest on Telemetry Now, I'd love to hear from you. Please reach out to us at telemetrynow@kentik.com. So for now, thanks so much for listening today. Bye-bye.